your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Along with me this evening is Tony Gosling. I'm going to let him tell you where he's from. But boy, it's somewhere where he's not usually broadcasting from. Welcome, Tony Gosling.
Well, I've got on a little aeroplane from Montenegro Airlines, George, last week, and ended up in the former Yugoslavia. And actually, we're quite close to Albania here, sandwiched in between Albania and Croatia. On the Montenegro coast, really beautiful part of the world, on the Adriatic Sea.
Oh, man, that's beautiful there, I bet.
It is, and we're getting a bit of Mediterranean sun here. Just first thing to say is that this is interesting, I think, historically around here, as well as being a beautiful place to eat out in the evenings, fantastic food. The locals are very, very friendly, generally speaking. Really nice crowd there. It's an Orthodox country, Orthodox church. Budva, which is pretty much near where we are, is supposed to be, anyway, the dividing line between the East and the Western Church. So in, I think it was 1154, my historical memory serves me right, is when the East and the Western Church is split, that is to say the Church of Rome and the Church of Constantinople. And so that's the beginning of the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church. And this, literally, around this area in Montenegro was the dividing line. So south of here would have been, and east of here would have been Orthodox, that is to say, down into Greece and Albania, etc. And north would have been Catholic from that time onwards. And it's still, I would suggest, where east meets west. A lot of Russian tourists here, and actually a lot of European tourists. The number plates on the cars tell a little story, which is there is no little European sign on the left-hand side of the blue band down the side of the number plates. So that tells you Montenegro is not in the European Union yet. It's very much would like to be, apparently. Although, of course,
right.
a lot of the signs are that the wind is changing in the EU. But nevertheless, they use the euro here. So it's interesting, isn't it, how not all countries that use the euro are actually in the European Union. They decided that their own currency was a bit dodgy, so they were convinced by so strong-armed on European Central Bank that, come on, get into the system, because, of course, the monetary system is used to control not only the political parties through the banks, but a lot of the country's economy is being controlled. Any country that enters into one of these big international currencies, including the dollar, is going to start to be controlled from outside. That's the way that oligarchy works. But all in all, very beautiful place and lovely people. And interesting to chat to some of the locals about the history of Yugoslavia and what happened, because if you go back to the 1980s, 70s, 60s, 50s, you'll find that Yugoslavia presented a fascinating balance between East and West, didn't it, economically, with the constitution of Tito, the President Tito, who was 88 when he died in 1980, I think it was. So he was in his 50s when he was fighting in World War II. And commanding 800,000 partisans. I mean, the story of World War II is really not necessarily very well known. The only one that's read up about Bill Donovan and Bill Stevenson as well, will know that Yugoslavia was absolutely crucial in winning the war. I would say that, but it was. And the reason was that the British and the Americans had intercepted German communications early in 1941 that told them that the Germans were secretly planning to attack Russia, attack the Soviet Union. And so they did a lot of quick thinking, mostly over in the Rockefeller Center, which is where the British and Roosevelt and Churchill's liaison was based there before even the Americans entered the war. And in the Rockefeller Center, they decided, look, we've got to make sure that when Hitler invades Yugoslavia, which was the penultimate invasion before he was going to Barbarossa and he was going to invade the Soviet Union, that they made that a very difficult invasion, because Hitler had already done a lot of work in Yugoslavia in wooing some of the ruling classes to say, well, you know, when we invade, when we take over Yugoslavia, everything's going to be fine. The Italians are very nice people, etc. Everything's going to be cool. So Bill Donovan went on a mission early in 1941 over to Yugoslavia and arranged for various top Nazi sympathisers across Yugoslavia to be bumped off. And so they were unceremoniously killed. Several of them made it look like accidents and that sort of thing.
Right.
In order to try and make sure that when the Nazis did invade Yugoslavia, that actually there was a massive amount of resistance. So what happened was many of the divisions which were ready to attack the Soviet Union in place along the Eastern Front, about to attack Russia, had to come down and got bogged down for about 6 weeks down in Yugoslavia, actually putting down the Yugoslavs, who were putting up a much bigger fight due to Bill Donovan than they were expecting. So George, this was crucial in delaying Barbarossa by 6 weeks.
Oh my God.
And that meant that Hitler's drive for Moscow, the now notorious Stalingrad, the turning point of the war, and at which point in the winter of 1941, basically all the fight went out of Hitler. Okay, the fight didn't go out of the Nazi forces, of the SS, the Wehrmacht, etc. But Hitler never made big public speeches, the big public rallies after Stalingrad, because he knew he'd lost the war. And from that moment on, it was all kind of downhill really for Hitler. But Yugoslavia played a key part in all that, as did Donovan. But many people don't realize that.
Well, Tito was the strong man in there, wasn't he, eventually?
Yes, he was. There was obviously a lot of efforts during World War II. By the OSS, once the Americans had entered the OSS, took over from the BSC, which was the Churchill-Roosevelt secret liaison group in the Rockefeller Center. And so they took over, really. And there was a lot of supplying of partisans in Eastern Europe, a massive amount of guns and ammunition. Eventually came to Tito, but Churchill wasn't very keen on the left wing. He wanted to support the right wing partisans, which were very ineffective actually in Yugoslavia and in some of the other countries in Eastern Europe. And there was a lot of pressure put on Churchill by other people in the Special Operations Executive.
Well, you know, the Catholic Church ran some terrorist organizations along with the Nazis during World War II in that area, didn't they?
Who's that?
During World War II, I believe that the Catholic Church sided with the Nazis in there.
Well, they did. Well, I mean, listen, okay. I think it's not quite fair to say the Catholic Church. I think you've got to look closer at the Vatican.
Yeah.
So we're talking about the top. So we're talking about the examples would be cardinals and bishops.
Right.
In Croatia, particularly.
Yeah.
In Croatia, it was a very, very strong Nazi right wing. And of course, the same exact thing was true at the end of World War II, when most of the rat lines over into Switzerland, places like the Tyrol, which by the way was where the Bilderbergers last met in Austria, Switzerland, these areas and this is a whole other side of this, is that I noticed that quite often the Bilderbergers meet in places which are significant in what you might call hidden history, occult history, like the Palace of Versailles. You know, these places are important to them. The Zwinger in Dresden last year, I don't think the same quite is true in the United States, but certainly they seem to love doing these tours of European history, of the power of the secret government behind the scenes, which of course is what they represent today. But it's a beautiful part of the world. I went to Tito's villa yesterday, which was actually only one of about 30 villas Tito had built across Yugoslavia, and it was built towards the end of his life in 1975 as a kind of therapy centre. So one of the interesting things I heard, George, from the tour guide was that the Queen actually came to Yugoslavia and met Tito, but didn't come to this villa down here in a place called Segnovi, which is right close to the Serbian border. Actually, what happened was Prince Charles came and met the year before Tito died, came over, I think it was, or maybe 1978, 2 years before he died. Prince Charles was over here having secret meetings, which were never announced to the press. So Prince Charles, I imagine, flew into one of the airports, was driven in anonymously into Tito's villa and had secret meetings with him. Just before he died. So that was, I thought, quite significant in that, you know, what exactly is Prince Charles up to? Acting as a kind of self-appointed ambassador or what, you know?
Right. Very intriguing. A lot of intrigue there in there.
Well, there was. And of course at the time, I don't know how much you know about this, but in 1949, after World War II, as many of the Eastern European countries which had been occupied by the Soviet Union were, around about that time, they were, and in the 1950s, they were quite often there were opposition movements within those countries, like Bulgaria, Hungary, and it's now what we call the tankies. So in Britain, I don't know if you have the same nickname in America, but there are types of left-wing, communists or what, but the tankies are the ones who supported the Russian intervention in Eastern Europe by sending in the tanks, which is what they did in places like Hungary, and where there was any kind of popular uprising, the Russians would just crush it. And there were some left-wingers who were stupid enough to think that was good, that was the right thing to do. But anyhow, so if you go back to 1949, Stalin massed them on the border of Yugoslavia because he was saying, we want to control you. Yeah? He was having negotiations, I imagine, with Tito at the time. But Tito was absolutely adamant. He said, you're not coming into our country. Anyone that knows anything about the history, for example, of the Spanish Civil War, will know that when the anarchists and the far left had been fighting against Franco, at the end of that war, the Russians turned on them. You know, people who've been their allies, the Russians would then, not the Russians, the Soviet troops turned on these other left wingers and started killing them, basically.
My
God. Took their weapons off them, and if they wouldn't relinquish their weapons. So the idea was that there was only one powerful left wing force, that was the Soviet Union, and there would be only one powerful, I suppose, capitalist right wing force, that was the United States. So in Britain, we didn't really have much of a choice. We didn't get any choice over whether the American troops were going to stay in Britain or not, because they just didn't go home. In the former Yugoslavia, Tito was absolutely adamant, no, those Soviet troops are not coming into my country. If they decide they want to come in, my million or so well-trained soldiers will kill them, and we're going to have a big, big fight, and they're not coming here. So eventually Stalin backed down, and Yugoslavia remained an independent country with actually a very, very fantastic kind of capitalist stroke, not really communist, it was more of a socialist constitution, which for example allowed workers places on the boards of big companies. Any business with more than about 20, 30 employees, the workers are allowed onto the board of the business. They have a representative directly speaking to the other directors. These sorts of things made Yugoslavia very successful. For example, with the Yugo cars, they had actually a very good, and also long holidays, lots of rights for people at work to have days off. very, very good education system, etc., and a very good healthcare system. Now, I can tell you, a lot of that is gone. You've got privatised things like massive privatised beaches. A lot of the public transport that used to be public has all been privatised. It's all a bit haphazard, and it's the usual sort of. It seems to be going sort of more towards a more of a third world style. You know, dog eat dog, everyone trying to compete with everybody else, and the cartels kind of moving in system nowadays.
Boy, I tell you, that's bad, isn't it?
It's a shame to see, because, you know, Yugoslavia represented a very successful model in its constitution for a halfway house between capitalism and communism. And I suppose neither the capitalists nor the communists were going to accept that.
Right. The continued influx of you could say the Islam crusades into or Muslim crusades into Europe are continuing. What's going on there in Western Europe?
I don't agree with you. I mean, I think the only crusade I can see is the one by the Anglo-Zionist Empire into the Middle East. You know, I'm talking about the paying of hundreds of thousands of mercenaries over the last few years in places like Libya and Syria. Much of the Islamic terrorism, I think, in Europe, as Sybil Evans has pointed out, is actually organised by, you know, what you would call the deep state in the West. What they want is they want fear and they want terror. I mean, for example, you look at the terrorist attacks that I've looked at closely. I haven't looked that deeply into Barcelona. But I can tell you, in the UK, we had three terrorist attacks in the run-up to our general election. All of those people should have been right under the nose of the security services. In fact, one guy from Manchester, Salman Abedi, his father was a top agent of MI6, so he was right under their noses. And I don't necessarily think he had the right profile, the right character to carry out an act like this. I think what's happening is that we're getting remote control bombs, that sort of thing, being blown up, and these people being kidnapped and possibly killed. And the other thing is, many of these people, George, we've got this thing called the anti-terror hotline in Britain. You're supposed to phone anyone that you get suspicious about and dob them into the government. Actually, it's MI5 really running it. And those hotlines have been phoned with these various people several times for these attackers on the London Bridge as well, for example, and the one at Westminster Bridge, and the guy in Manchester. All these people have been reported to MI5 saying, look, this guy, I think he could become a terrorist or something.
Yeah.
Instead of actually acting on these tip-offs and following, putting these people under surveillance, somehow these people have got hold of God knows what explosives, knives and whatever, and they've done these attacks. Now, it's not good enough for the security services just to hold their hands up and say, sorry, there's nothing we can do. No. You should have been following, tracing, tracking, using human intelligence, not necessarily the internet, because they don't use the internet. And, you know, get people to befriend them, etc., and keep a very close eye on them. Use human intelligence. I mean, we're paying these MI5 people enough. And I would suggest that the anti-terror hotline should be renamed the Jihadi Recruitment MI5 tip-off line.
Support line.
So when you phone in somebody you suspect of being something that's slightly, you know, maybe veering towards the violent Islamic faction,
right,
you know, which of course 99.9% of Muslims are just not like that. They've been involved, by the way, very much in helping in areas like, for example, in Manchester, at Grenfell Tower, with that terrible tragedy with the fire burning this whole block of flats down in Ladbroke Grove in London. The Islamic community have actually organised better than the government, George. So they have been actually helping out as many Muslims, and the mosques have become like the churches maybe used to be, and also have become as well. The mosques and the churches have been doing far more to help the communities that have been broken by these attacks and by these disasters than the government has. The government has just totally failed.
Well, you know,
in fact,
yeah.
One of the things that happened in, just to show you the character of this government, the Conservatives in Kensington and Chelsea actually went to the local people and said, okay, here's some money for you, but you have to sign this little piece of paper and then we'll give you the money. And at the bottom of the piece of paper was, I waive all my rights to sue Kensington and Chelsea Council over this tragedy. And so while people were basically in shock, they were being told to sign away their rights to sue the people who are responsible for killing their friends and family. So, you know, this is the attitude of the government. We've got effectively a criminal elite takeover with a bunch of spivs, gangsters and chancers running the show. And the only reason that we've still got any kind of civilised society is because we've got a bit of a hangover from the old days when people used to think that being in politics meant that you had to be decent. Many of the people who are most successful now in business and politics are the most ruthless, and they're veering towards criminal enterprises because they can see there's very little real rule of law to stop criminal organisations like the criminal banks, like HSBC, etc., money laundering, you know, breaking the law left, right and centre. And so I'm afraid it's kind of a race to the bottom when it comes to morality and big business.
Well, it's like Spectre's in control, right?
Like
Spectre, you know, out of 007? Yeah, well, it's resembling worldwide that Bilderberg is like Spectre.
Well, remember, it's not only China, it doesn't include Russia, so there's a big piece missing.
Yeah,
anyway,
yeah, I know.
Is this world domination, same old dream.
Right. Yeah.
What they're dreaming of, that it's quite clear they're not going to get it. It's a bit like Hitler after Stalingrad, really. But we've seen some really interesting things, I think, over the last week. Fascinating news stories. One of them is the German police raiding the homes of men who were plotting to kill left-wing leaders. One of the suspects is believed to be a policeman. This was in the Daily Mirror on Monday, and not reported anywhere, as far as I could see, on the BBC. But interesting to see that the German police are prepared to take on fascists within their own ranks. That is to say, fascist cops who look like they might be trying to interfere in the whole political process, pump off left-wing leaders, especially in the run-up to this general election in a couple of weeks' time, the police are prepared to act. Also, not to forget that a couple of months ago, there was a similar thing in the army in Germany, where they discovered Nazi cells, fascist cells, who were plotting terrorist attacks to blame them on Muslims. This is where it comes back to this, it's a Muslim crusade? No, it was a crusade by the German army. Actually, what this German army guy's done is he's got himself registered. He was an army lieutenant. He got himself registered as a Syrian refugee undercover, and he was leaving a trail, George, for people to trace this Syrian refugee, but actually it was a German army officer. You can look this up online if you want. And it sounds amazing, but it's true. He was preparing to plant a bomb at Vienna Airport, a German army officer, and he left a trail with his false identity. It sounds like something from a John le Carré novel. It probably is, actually. That's probably where they get these ideas, in order to blame it on the Syrian refugees. So that's what we're going to see now. We're going to see more and more of these terror attacks across Europe, possibly in the US as well, blamed on Muslims. We've got to really understand that this is exactly what was being planned in the 1930s in Germany, to set the Islamic community up as terrorists. Actually, it's NATO intelligence. There's no NATO intelligence services, including the Mossad, who have absolutely no accountability whatsoever over what they do. And we've had Operation Gladio as a kind of dry run for this in the 1970s and 1980s, where these bomb attacks were carried out by fascist cells, controlled by NATO, controlled by P2 and the secret government behind the scene, effectively big business, the secret services, the police, top political leaders, top newspaper people, media people, bankers, deciding basically, well, we don't like this government. We're going to kill the Prime Minister and we're going to blame it on the Russians. And now they're doing exactly the same sort of thing, but they're blaming it on the Muslims. If people aren't up to speed with this, I think you've really got to check out some of the work done by former FBI translator Sybil Edmonds. He's really uncovered lots and lots of stuff. And the Turks are right onto this as well too now, and I think are spinning off from NATO because they've realised that NATO is actually part of the problem, not the solution to terrorism.
Yeah, that Erdogan is something else, isn't he?
Well, yeah, they seem to be actually fairly independent, but I'm guessing more that they're starting to talk more to the Russians than people realise. Also, there is an incredible scandal developing in Britain. I think it's an incredible scandal, which is a thing called HS2. HS2 is high-speed rail 2, and it's a special series of new trains which are apparently going to run between London and Birmingham and Manchester, and it's the biggest white elephant I've seen in my entire life.
Oh my gosh.
Trying to do is build this new railway line along similar parallel to an existing track. Well, why the hell do you want to do that? First of all, I don't know. And I've had a good look at this, and it's not going to lead to one single person leaving their car behind and going on a train instead. The idea is that it's existing rail passengers. But the most incredible thing about it is the price. We've now heard an independent, not the people themselves, expert in the field saying it's going to be, the cost is going to be over £200 billion.
Oh my God.
Now this is, we're talking about a fifth of a trillion pounds for this rail line. I don't actually think they're going to ever build it, to be honest with you. Rather like the Hinkley Power Station down in Somerset, which I also think is another white effort, which is never actually going to get built. The idea is, I would suggest, economic warfare projects. Right? So the idea is to do something which is not going to actually help your country at all, but it's going to cost an absolute fortune, mostly for foreign companies, in this case French and German companies building this railway, and it's going to cripple you, basically. And that's what the purpose of the railway is.
My gosh.
I was chatting to Manfred Petrich. I don't know if you know him. I met him at Bilderberg meeting several years ago. And Manfred, he's a former Swiss banker. He lives now on the Black Sea. And he knows a bit about money. I quoted him the figure of $111 billion, which is one of the previous estimates of this rail project. And it's all the big thing in Britain. Everyone's saying, oh, HS2, isn't it going to be wonderful? The media keeps talking about it.
Yeah.
But it's a total and utter disaster. He said, for £200 billion, you can build a railway right the way around the world. Why are you spending it on a
railway? Man.
Manchester, you're crazy. Well, of course, it's not crazy. It's a part of an economic sabotage against Britain. And that, of course, is what we've been seeing this week with more and more. And we haven't heard the last of it. I suppose you'd call it disagreements between the British and Brussels over Brexit. They're saying we've got to pay some massive bill. Well, hang on a minute. What do you mean we've got to pay a bill? Surely what happens is the money that's going backwards and forwards between Brussels and London at some point just stops. And we're not paying any bills.
Right.
Why should we pay a penny?
Right.
They're trying to impose all these... Basically, it's like dealing with the mafia. In fact, in a way, we are dealing with
the European Union is like that.
We're going to get punished big time. One of the reasons, I was just looking at another story to do with railways, because Britain was where the railway was invented. We had a brilliant railway system up until 1963, when a guy called Richard Beeching, he was in charge of the ICI, he was one of the people involved in the war as well, ICI explosives, and he was doing the atomic bomb. Britain in the 1950s. Once he finished that, he didn't know anything about railways, but he decided that we were going to close down half Britain's railway. And now, of course, in the 1990s, since that denuded railway network was then privatised. So we're now in a situation where, and this is amazing really, foreign-backed investors get £200 million a year from Britain's privatised railway, just by leasing the trains to them.
Oh my God!
In order to actually just, as soon as you buy your ticket, immediately, a percentage of that is just flying off to a foreign investor straight away. And this is why these things were nationalised in the first place, because infrastructure, I think, infrastructure should be provided at cost. It shouldn't be a racket where somebody somewhere is making a load of money out of you. And if your country's going to be successful, let's provide the electricity, let's provide the transport, or at least the rail transport, basic, you know, stuff to get around. Let's provide the buses. Let's provide all those services, including banking, by the way, which is also a utility, although people don't realise it, at cost. And if we can do that, suddenly all the other things that we need to do to be a successful economy can happen much more easily, and someone is not taking from the infrastructure of the country. I think that's another thing this week is the Conservatives have been caught joking about gassing Chavs. Chavs, I don't know if you're familiar with the term, but they are this sort of, these basically like fairly ignorant, but generally very good-hearted poor people. Yes.
Oh, you're kidding me. Talking
about shooting the peasants.
Oh, my God.
Breathe too much, despite they sleeping rough. So they're saying that the people who have been turfed out of their homes because they're too poor and are now sleeping in tents and maybe in the woods, breathe too much.
Right.
Those people who have been thrown out of their homes, well, we did that to mess them up, and they're still breathing too much. Maybe we should just shoot the peasants and gas the chads. Now, this is a serious conservative youth movement who should know better. But anyway, their WhatsApp messages have been leaked, and over two or three days this week, there's been quite a lot of disgusting, disgust at this kind of eugenics style, arrogant Lord Snooty, and it what is getting towards being rather fascistic attitude of the Conservative Party, where if someone is poor and if they're not productive, then they may as well just die. I mean, you know, I'm surprised they're not talking about putting them in concentration camps, but they are.
That sort of sounds like the poor laws. Remember those?
That's right. I mean, and it's
just a different version of it or something.
I just think that, you know, that is another piece of news which maybe hasn't made its way across the Atlantic. A lot of this stuff, you know, you have to search quite hard for it, and it won't often make its way onto the broadcast media. I don't know if you've heard about another story which I noticed and made its way into the mainstream press a little bit. Only through two or three outlets in Germany, even, which is that we've had some senior German politicians talking about kicking out American nukes from Germany. I don't know if that made the news in the US. George, did it?
Well, I don't know. I didn't pick up on that yet. I didn't.
Well, it's because this is extremely significant.
Right.
The German politicians are in the run-up to their general election, saying, well, actually, we're going to stand on an election platform of removing all US nuclear weapons from Germany. Now, of course, that means East Germany and West Germany nowadays, right? And it means a lot of nuclear weapons are going to be going home. And you know why they're saying that? It's very simple. It's simply because in any kind of conflict, and of course we're seeing the diplomatic rows ramping up just today, more rows with the Russian consulates in California, DC, etc. The Americans saying, no, you're going to have to get the Russian. The Germans are watching this and they're saying, what the hell are you playing at, Trump?
Oh,
and of course, this isn't necessarily Trump behind this, but he has to go along with it now. He's surrounded by these neocons, these hawks, these Goldman Sachs people. And as the Germans see this, they think, well, if you want a conflict with Russia, we don't want any of your nuclear weapons on our soil, thank you very much. This kind of started last year, didn't it, with the big debacle with Volkswagen, with the Americans saying you've been cheating on emissions, and this is the first sign. I think the first sign that relationship between Germany and the US is breaking down. And that was because the Germans refused to back the US in Syria. There was an attempt through the chemical weapons thing to try to get the Europeans, which is effectively led by the Germans, to get involved in the Syria conflict, send troops, etc., and back it. The Germans just said, no, we have nothing to do with this. We're not fighting the Russians for you, you know. And I think this is the latest. But, I think every NATO country, including Britain, needs to now, if these people are serious, they need to be looking at what the hell are we doing with American nuclear weapons on our soil. Because if the United States wants to have a war with Russia, then they can do it over the North Pole, and they can do it across the Bering Straits. They're not having that war in Europe. So we need to get our nukes right out of the way.
Right. Well, Tony, boy, that was quite a report, I'll tell you. And, I hope, how much longer do you have on your vacation there, Montenegro?
Just a few more days. And by the way, when I get back, we're doing a 9/11 special program.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, for the 16th anniversary. The idea really is to get Ian Henshaw on, who's a British author, wrote a book alongside a co-author called... what's it called now? I was trying to remember his book's title. Anyway, his book is really excellent. It's a tiny little, it's like almost, I don't know what you call it, A4 size kind of. Well, quite
okay.
A4 is too big. Anyway, it's a small book, A5 size, that's what it is.
Okay.
But it's really packed with pictures and info about 9/11. And it's called 9/11, The New Evidence. And this, of course, is aimed at anybody at all who's starting to realise 9/11 has led to all this crazy...
It has. It's been
so maybe I should take another look at 9/11. And if you want to do that, Ian's book is one of the best. So we'll have clips of interviews with Dave von Kleist, and Manfred Petrich, I just mentioned there, from the Smoke and Mirrors blog. I think he was born in Argentina actually, son of a Nazi, because, you know, he was only in Argentina for a while, then he came back to Europe. Also a clip with Susan Lindauer, something from Barry Jennings, and I think we'll probably have a bit from, rest in peace, good old Jim Mars as well. So we'll be having all sorts. And the other thing is we're going to try and get Christopher Bollin on, who I met first at Bilderberg back in 2000 in Jonval in Switzerland when he was taking photos there.
Oh, okay.
And I think he's done a fantastic job with his book, Solving 9/11, in starting to look at the links to the foreign policy objectives of the Israelis and the dual citizen Israeli-American citizens who seem to have been some of the key people in the cover-up after the 9/11 attacks in making sure that there was never any proper investigation into what happened. So, of course, you know, the suspicion's got to be...
Well, there's a legal group, too, out of New York now of attorneys that are pursuing criminal-type charges.
Well, yes, this is difficult, isn't it? Because, again,
yeah.
people have settled out of court. A lot of the families were forced to settle out of court. So this is an important part of the cover-up was almost second wave of efforts to make sure, that, a bit like with JFK assassination,
right.
You know, Warren Commission was an important part of making sure that they could get away with that assassination. And then a whole machine goes into motion to sort of have a pretense of an investigation, like a lot of the mainstream.
Exactly, yeah.
To investigate the 9/11 attacks. As we know, you know, there's actually quite a lot of evidence that...
9/11, though, that what they did was they started a premise that it was a foreign attack. See what I mean? And stayed away from any criminal type of action. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. So it wasn't... People were not looking inside, yeah.
Yeah, see what I mean? And this group in New York...
It's the same modus operandi, if you think about it. It's the same modus operandi with the terrorists in Europe.
The JFK thing, we had an attorney general in Texas at that time. And, of course, LBJ said, you stay out of it. See what I mean? And so, you know what I mean, how that went.
Even Jim Garrison didn't manage to quite get, I mean, I think the most, for me, the most explosive thing on the JFK ever has got to be that interview with James Files. Because he shows all of the characteristics of being the guy that actually...
Well, he has evidence there that in his testimony of the actual shooting locations there, some of those.
Exactly. And the thing is, I mean, he's also got all of the names of all of the other people.
Roselli and those people that were at the top of the mafia, out of Chicago and stuff. He had a lot of good, important names there.
Yeah, and so, of course, this, in a way, was, I suppose, if you think about the end of World War II as a kind of big celebration, everyone thought, oh, you know, the oligarchy is gone, fascism has been beaten. In a way, you've got these two stages between there and now. One was the JFK assassination, which was really a very, very strong message to the American political elite that I'm afraid that this country is not going to be a democracy. It's going to be run by the oligarchy. Yeah?
Exactly.
Anyone thinks it's going to be a democracy, if you try and make any changes which really affect the power of the oligarchy, you're going to end up like JFK. A very strong signal to anybody entering politics that if they did it at their own risk, you know, that they were probably going to get their heads blown off. And of course, then with 9/11, it then meant the end of the international rule of law. I mean, really, that meant that the United Nations were going to be very much sidelined, the UN Security Council sidelined, and that it was going to be a carte blanche to march into anywhere where you thought there might be a terrorist. And, of course, the latest one of these, I'm afraid, is Russia. We even had a program on the BBC today. I'm trying to think of what it was called, George. It was an unbelievable program. I think it's... it was called Punt PI, P-U-N-T-P-I, a guy called Steve Punt, and he did a program on the BBC prime time this morning, Saturday morning, that is September the 2nd, 2017, which was all about missing nuclear weapons, right? And how the person with the most of them is, guess who? Vladimir Putin.
Oh, my God.
All these suitcase bombs. Now, this looks to me like predictive programming, right?
Yeah, it is.
The idea is you tell people Putin has got lots of missing nuclear weapons, you get a nuclear false flag, and then the idea is that everybody automatically in their own mind, without even being told on the news, thinks Putin. That's the way I think these people operate, is through the mainstream press, and I doubt there are very, very, I would say, harsh words with Punt, with Steve Punt, who did this program on the BBC today, because it looks to me as if that may be part of something that everybody's been talking about for many years, but no one's actually seen, thank God, yet, which is a nuclear false flag, which seems to be where they're going as the next big kind of 9/11-style oligarchic move in order to try and force regime change in Russia. Actually, that would be a total disaster, of course, and the Russians know that any kind of military attack against them would be, with tanks, soldiers, guns, would be easily driven back. But of course, a nuclear exchange is a whole new idea, and that, well, we'll see. Let's hope to God that doesn't happen, but, you know, I think we just need to be aware that that's how crazy some of our so-called leaders are. And also, they're losing their credibility. The United States has got really very, very little credibility around the world nowadays. Britain a little bit still, but everyone that has more to do with the United States also gets less credibility. And the Russians seem to be, many people have a lot of respect for the Russians because they've been holding the Americans, keeping the international rule of law, effectively being a kind of de facto United Nations in the Middle East, George.
Right. Well, Tony, well, thank you for being with us this evening. We certainly enjoyed everything. And
One of the things I didn't mention, which I ought to.
Okay,
really,
go ahead.
Just briefly, is this guy, Frank Thompson, because he was sent over to Eastern Europe by the Special Operations Executive in World War II.
Oh, okay.
Partisans, basically to be like a radio operator and to bring in supplies of ammunition, guns, explosives for sabotage to the various partisan groups in Eastern Europe occupied by the Nazis. And Frank was the elder brother of, he was unfortunately caught, although there is some suggestion that because he was very left-wing, that the British Army actually wanted him to get caught. I don't think there's any hard evidence for it, but some say, I know. He was actually wounded by the Bulgarian gendarmerie, and when he was working with the partisans in 1944, captured, and he was then executed by firing squad in the village of Litakvo. And the locals really liked him, and they were very upset when he was executed, and they even named a village, several villages in Bulgaria, as Thompson. They were still called Thompson to this day.
Oh man, that's nice, isn't it?
He's lovely. But his younger brother, E.P. Thompson, wrote many books about Britain's history. I mean, he was absolutely, I think, one of the best. If anyone's interested in the real deep roots of British history, E.P. Thompson, one of his books is called Customs in Common, which is one of the things I read, quite a while ago now. But it's one of those fantastic books you can descend into just the world of, say, the 1600s or the 1700s.
Really?
Where the landlords were in charge, the feudal system was running the show, and it was just the way that the labourers kind of tried to get organised to actually get a bit of freedom, even despite these draconian rules. For example, that they weren't allowed to get any pheasants, or they weren't allowed to get any food, hares or whatever. So they kept all of the resources people needed to live away from them. And of course, all the locals in Britain would always try to grab them where they could, even apples, things like that. If you were caught grabbing an apple, you could be, really severely punished. So his book about the roots of British culture, and about the enclosures, and the ordinary working people in the times, in the agricultural revolution and the industrial revolution, is some of the best historical research and writing you'll find known to man. So anyway, that's another thing, and people don't necessarily remember the Thompson brothers, one of whom died helping the partisans in Bulgaria, and the other whom became an incredibly successful author, spied on constantly by MI5.
Well, they have a lot of good things to stand for, don't they?
Yeah. Okay, so thanks very much for having a chat, George.
Okay, Tony, thank you very much.
God bless, and we'll speak soon.
God bless. Have a good evening. Bye-bye. Thank you again, Tony. You've always been a wealth of information, European history and so forth, world history, which is what we need to do. We need to put a little bit of foundation behind some of our broadcasts at times, because without knowing some of the history, then how can we appreciate what's going on in the present and have some kind of idea about what may be projected in the future? Well, here in Texas, we've just gotten out of this Harvey monstrosity of a hurricane. And it, by gosh, it came in there right north of Corpus Christi. And the wind damage got up to 125, 30 miles an hour. But the real story, or one of the other story, main stories, is the flooding in Houston was horrendous. It dropped over 50 inches of rain over a short period of time. And people now are drying out, beginning to dig out their homes between a few inches, like a friend of mine had. He had 3 inches in his home, and other people have had 4 or 5 feet, or some people have had their whole houses flooded, and that's a big loss. So people in Houston today are digging out, trying to, gather up their, few belongings, and seeing whether or not they can go back in to some of the houses. I was noticing today, I was watching some videos and so forth, and there's some people out there that are digging out the floor and breaking it up and putting it out on the curbside for pickup, for trash pickup and so forth, for debris trucks to come through eventually. President Trump is back in Houston today with Melania, First Lady, and they were down there and squeezing hands and hugging kids and giving a little compassion that they didn't really have time to do the first time. When he came down the first time, he met with our governor and the officials that managed, you could say, the crisis and the hurricane and so forth. And they did a wonderful job. I mean, I don't think you could have had a better management team to enter in. And they opened up the Cajun Navy came in from Louisiana, and the Redneck Army from Texas, and they actually opened it up and allowed individuals to participate and go out and pull people off their roofs, pull them out of their houses, put them in their boats, and they had all kinds of fishing boats. I mean, Texans love to fish, and along the coast there, you're going to have a lot of fishermen. So that really went well, you know, and I think that's sort of Texan, get up and go, let's get it done. And that's really Greg Abbott, our fine governor, along with our President Trump, worked together along with those good officials and addressed the problem, I think, about as well as anyone could. And as a result, I think we pulled more people out, they did, and saved more people more quickly through the catastrophe, through the hurricane, than about anyone else could have. But I want to thank both Greg Abbott and President Trump for all their efforts and all those people out there. And, you know, when you think of it, I was thinking about just the Houston street and maintenance people. Just think of all the barricades they had to put up and pull down during the hurricane. My gosh, they had to blockade off roads and then go back up and make sure that people were diverted early enough. And that Houston bunch down there, they did well too. And Acevedo, a former police chief of Austin, is a police chief in Houston. And I think overall, just everyone performed real well. So it's coming around now. It's drying out. Thank goodness a hurricane there, right there on the edge. It ended up being right there at Houston's north, right to the east of Houston. But it finally veered off to the northeast, and it opened up dry weather, warm weather, sunny weather is what they needed. And, of course, they're worried now about this Irma, but that's way out in the Atlantic still. But anyway, it's amazing what coordination. The Katrina, they were not allowing outsiders in enough to help. And I think the governor at the time of Louisiana had a real problem, you know, on that. And I don't blame him. This time, Harvey worked out much better because there was close a working relationship between the governor, Greg Abbott, and President Trump. Now, let's go back a few weeks here to Charlottesville, okay, Virginia. It has finally come out with all the criticism that President Trump got from the press, the media. And, you know, the media is owned by the deep state. So the deep state owns the media. So they're like a bunch of parrots out here, see. And so they just hit at him and hit at him and keep hitting at him. And, of course, because he said there were some fine people, they're trying to lobby against the takedown of the Confederate statues. Then they started taking that and saying, well, he's for the KKK. He's for the white supremacists. They just automatically placed that on him. Then they went even steps further and they said anyone that voted for Trump is a Nazi. They said Trump is a Nazi. Anyone that voted for Trump is a Nazi. And, you know, we need to address the whole bunch of them, see. And so this got to be totally out of control. Antifa, the anti-fascist organization, has finally been revealed about what they're all about. And what they're all about is Marxist communism, Maoism, and they got anarchists in there too. And that's what they're about. They're just using this anti-fascist thing as a cover to push their own theology of communism, one flavor or another. But with violence, see, and they're advocating all this violence is necessary to quieten these fascists who should not have any freedom of speech rights in this country, according to them. The problem with Antifa is they were the decider about who deserved the freedom of speech, period. So they themselves were beginning to act like gods. So what, you know, God men, you heard that before? Isn't that the age-old problem? It goes on. It goes goes on and on. It goes on and on. It hardly ever, it ever dissipates. Men themselves as individuals, and this is what I talk about, and I've talked about it over the years, is what I call the man problem. See, the man problem is that male ego. And men begin to think themselves as gods. Towards the end of the Roman Empire, you had emperors thinking themselves and becoming gods, see. And so this is part of the problem that men have, see. But men don't know that. And they never, most of the time, they never awaken to that. They're sort of develop into some kind of an ego. And if money is a problem because it reinforces that ego state to a severe degree sometimes. So you have a more of a problem in the moneyed classes of severe egos. And those egos can manifest into psychopathic type characters. And that's who we have running the government and controlling everything and at the top of this power thing. And also, I got to thinking the other day is that, you know, all these groups out here are being funded. Well, you know who they're being funded by? The biggest corporations in the world. Why are they being funded by the biggest corporations in the world? Because we're headed towards corporate fascism. So these little Antifa guys come running around out here thinking they're onto something, and they're going in here and clubbing KKK members. They're not even in the game. And Antifa's not in the game either. Their leader, Mark Bray's written a book, and the first book that he wrote, I scanned it and didn't have one word about the Fed in it. So he's being funded possibly by some of these leaders, you know, from behind these corporate interests from behind the scenes. Why are these corporations funding this stuff? They're funding it to level this country down and take us into much more of a subservient type of subsistent type of economic, where they can pay us what they want and then do with us what they want, basically. So it doesn't look good. It doesn't look good. When you look at all the money that's being funneled into these very, very left-wing, very far to the left groups, that's what you're going to find out there. So you've got to be able to decipher this system, but outside of the system. We're attending schools, and we have some people out there with some fine degrees that are listening to this program every weekend. We broadcast between 7 and 9 on 89.1 FM in Austin, Texas. And Charlotte Littlefield and I have been on the air for over 10 years, be 11 years in November. So we began to understand early on that we were trying to speak to an audience that was at times little educated, and at times, part of the mix was well-educated. But everyone has been conditioned to certain definitions of organizations and structure and sociological, psychological terms and just all kinds of definitions of terms and so forth. And in defining all of these terms using, different customs and so forth, you have a conditioning process that has occurred. And this conditioning process has become regimented, see. And so the whole program of Mind Marsh is using and utilizing an existing set of definitions to reiterate and make points, see. But when you're making those points, you're making those points within a certain box diagram type of thinking, see. And so everyone is in a box diagram type of thinking, and no one is thinking outside the box but the manipulators and the elitists. And they're the ones pulling the strings that go back into the boxes, right? And we're sitting there like a bunch of puppets, see? And we're fools for going for much of what they've been dangling before us over a number of years. But we can't see it because the delusion that I maintain is very great and very deep. And it's operative on a very, very deep psychological level. And at this deep psychological level, we cannot see that we're in a deluded state, see. And so because we're too smart to think that we're deluded to begin with, because we're sharp, see. We think we know what we're doing. But we're not as smart as we think we are, see. And as a result, we just fail to come out of this condition, mind-washed, mind-controlled state of delusion. And anyway, I want to thank everyone for listening out there. And we'll be back next weekend. And we've got followed up this first hour as our second hour. So stay tuned. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.